Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody, and happy 13th anniversary. We appreciate everybody that's been joining us. A lot of y'all have been with us from that first January in 2010 that we started off. And for those that are going to help us celebrate live, I'd like to go ahead and extend an invitation, as always. If you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that's where you will find the chat room. We'll be monitoring that during the course of the show. And we're just going to have a kind of a free-for-all anniversary chat fest. So if there's something that y'all wanted to ask us that we haven't covered in one of our recent shows, put it in the chat room. We will more than happy to bring it into the conversation. We also, we'll open the studio line if anybody wants to call in. We've had a couple people call in the last few months, which has been great. It's area code 347-308-8397. It's also there on the show page, so if you're with us live, you can just go back there and catch it up. So, again, since January 2010, it has been a great opportunity to talk with a lot of folks about our Navy, about national security issues, and other topics that swirl around it. And as we mentioned a few months ago when he passed away, much earlier than usual, we started off 13 years ago. I wanted to mention one of our original co-hosts, Raymond Pritchard. He passed away a few months ago, and we spent some time talking about him earlier. If you missed that show, you can go back to earlier this fall. Last fall, and had a few things in background that we talked about Raymond as well. And I also want to give a shout out to the man that in late 2009 asked the question that gets a lot of things started, for better or worse. Have y'all ever thought, ... a friend, a frequent guest, and a man in his own right in the national security arena, Claude Barrabe. He talked to Raymond and Mark and myself and thought that it might be interesting now that technology allowed for you to upload audios and these thing called podcasting was going on. Would that be something y'all be interested in doing? And lo and behold, 13 years ago, we did. And in the pre-show, my co-host and I were just talking about it. Sure hasn't seemed too long. 13 years. I don't know, Eagle One. I think next year, Midrats is going to go in front of the 05 board. Maybe they'll select early. I'm not sure.
Well, it would be nice if they did. We could, I don't know what we'd call it then, Admiral Rats, no, Commander Rats. Who knows? you know, it's been, it does not seem that long to me. We have just had so many great guests and so many great topics over the years, and our, you know, the people who to put up with the bad audio that we occasionally have, and all that, to really appreciate the people who listen to us and give us feedback and join in the chat room, and it's been great. But I also think we ought to mention it's just a remarkable lineup of people we've had on the show. You talk about Brian McGrath, Jerry Hendricks, Mark Vandroff, Mackenzie Eglin, Megan Eckstein, Sam Legrone, John Conrad, Matt Hipple, Jack McCain, Sam Tangredi, Robert Farley, Christian Broche. I got this Dimitri Gorenberg, Toshi Yashihara, James Holmes, Barney Rubel, Brent Sadler, Dean Chang. I've got this. I hate to say names because I'm afraid I'll miss anybody. Ross Kennedy, Tim Spahn, Blake Hersinger, Aliso Patalano. I think I got that right. And Sal Mercagliano, as long as I'm doing names that we all have trouble pronouncing. Pete Small, Tom Wright, Gray Connolly, Chris Raleigh, Alex Gray, I think. Jordan, I can't read my handwriting. Jordan Bradford, Hallie Geyer, I think. Ryan Hilger, and Claude, and I'm sure TJ, a bunch of other people that I'm sure I will remember later on. But going back over the list, it's been terrific, the people we've had on, the shows we've had. I went back and counted. We were prescient in a lot of ways. We talked about China early on. I think in 2010, we first had our first mention of China. We've had 23 shows specifically related to China. About Russia first in June of 2011, I think, and that was, and we've done 13 shows Russia specific even before they invaded Crimea and other parts of Ukraine. We just had a lot of fun with the show, and Afghanistan has been a big topic for us. I think we've had several shows on that and some of the problems and issues that arose out of the way we approached it. Obviously, Tom Wright was about Fat Leonard. We do a lot of talk about the size of the Navy, the types of ships we should have in the Navy, the Maritime Department. I think that's a Herzinger or Hipple suggestion. And not many other shows that I know of have been talking about logistics the way we've been talking about logistics and how vital it is to national security. So with that, I give us a big pat on the back for having great guests and giving them the freedom to talk about their ideas and what their thoughts are.
And I think that's also one of the neat things. We do apologize for our audio problems in the past, but you get what you pay for. And we don't have any sponsors or anything, so that gives us an opportunity to do what I know a lot of our guests really like, is we will do the unsexy but important. I know you mentioned Sal Mercagliano. You can't mention him without mentioning John Conrad. I think they get their feelings hurt if one is mentioned and the other one doesn't. But we've invested a lot of time in the Merchant Marine and the logistics. The stuff that may not be as exciting as how many bombs you can carry, how fast you can go, but as everybody knows, especially if you're looking to the Pacific, that is so critically important. And people are starting to talk about that now, so that's really nice to see. And what's also funny along the way, especially some of these names early on when we didn't have as large of a readership, listenership as we have right now. But it's kind of a life lesson that, as any salesman will tell you, that if you don't make the ask, you're definitely not going to get it. But over the course of the years, we had Bob Work come on. We had John Kirby come on. Representative Jim Banks has been with us. We even got Don Rumsfeld on, I think, in the first 3 years or so, or 4 years. When his health was still real strong, it was a really nice opportunity, and it's something that a few folks that we've brought on years ago that we've watched as their careers and their influence has grown. And two things that's been interesting is one is the continuity of a lot of the people in the discussion space. Earlier in the week, I look back at Robert Kaplan's 2007 article, America's Elegant Decline, and just, how's it aged up over 15 years? That was 3 years before Midrats started. But it has a lot of discussions with two of the people he quoted in there were Midrats guests, Bob Work and Claude Berube also gets quoted in Kaplan's article. And he brings up an issue that Representative Gallagher got into Congress that Brian McGrath has been advocating for a long time, which was changing the Title 10 requirement for the Navy, which for the executive summary is it actually forces the Navy to look at the peacetime presence mission and to do it right, so to speak. The attorneys can the summary of it. Words mean things. And so a lot of these issues that we've talked about through the years, here we are 13 years later, not that no progress is being made, but I think when you look at the topics that we've talked about, it underlines kind of a theme that you and I have talked about through the years, is there is a continuity to the requirements and the challenges in the maritime arena. They don't change with the latest buzzword of the day or the popular topic that everybody needs to insert in their FITREP or in their article. You can call it a variety of things, but at its core, the mission and the requirements are the same. And I look back, and we've done it before on previous anniversary shows, but we're going to do it again because I think it's fun. When you looked at January of 2010, our first 10 shows that Raymond, yourself, and I invested our time in, the first show was just the three of us chatting away, which was kind of funny. I was still learning the switchboard requirements, and nobody knows this because we stripped it out, but I didn't realize that when the show ended, the recording continued. So we had an after-show conversation for about 10 minutes that went up as the podcast until Raymond sent me a rather curt email telling me I needed to fix it. Because we talked out of school per se, but it was interesting for those that had a chance to read it, the couple of three that got it. Then episode two, we had Claude on to talk about piracy. And, you know, that's maybe something we could talk about later, is how piracy has changed or not changed. But that was a big issue in 2010 in both the Straits of Malacca and also off of the Horn of Africa. We had Brian McGrath on episode three, talked about the multipolar world and time travel back to 2010. We still had big wars going on, well, not compared to what's going on in Ukraine, but we still had significant numbers of high five figures, low four figures of forces in Afghanistan and Iraq. We had Lucien Gaultier, who's still on active duty, doing the Lord's work in a chief's mess on the West Coast. We'll have to – I exchange notes with Lucien every couple of months or so with his growing family. Great guy. But we had him and Charles Malone, Commander One Issue, U.S. Navy 05, who had just gotten through with a bonus command tour, I think it was, or special mission command tour. Basically, he was running one of the detention facilities in Iraq. So we talked about the sway boat Navy a bit. We had Mackenzie Eaglin on to talk about the QDR. And Mackenzie, she's over at AEI now. We've had her on a few times. She's also, since then, she's recommended a few guests to us. She's still out and a very influential person with a great head. I actually had a chance to meet her last year in person, and she is sharp. She's not very tall, but she's got an incredible head on her shoulders. We also had a discussion about the information space and the ecosystem with Phil Ewing and Bill Miller, who at that time was the publisher of USNI. And it seems like it wasn't that long ago, but we had Elaine Donnelly and Marcus on to talk about Don't Ask, Don't Tell, because that decision hadn't been made at that point. We had filmmakers Daniel Sekulak and Kevin Doherty on, to talk about piracy and the work they had done on it. We had a free-for-all for episode 9. In the 10th, we had Brian McGrath back on with Barney Rubble to talk about sea control. And we've had Barney and Brian have both been very kind through the years. I think we average having them on every couple, 3 years. And we have a lot of regular guests like that. In our first year, we had Dmitry Gorenberg, Dr. One Issue, on to talk about Russia. And what was interesting is the last time we had him on about a year ago, maybe less, or the one time before that, we talked about when we first had him on board at CNA, he was it, as we saw throughout the national security infrastructure. The Russia hands were all put out to pasture, and he was the Russia guy at CNA. Nobody else was there. Nobody was interested in Russia. And lo and behold, now I think he's the senior guy with a dozen other folks with him, because as everybody has known from 2022, Russia has, as most things do, it's regressed towards the mean and is being Russia again. And I just thought that was interesting, looking back at our first 10 shows. Piracy isn't a top 10 item anymore, though it's those task forces are still operating off the Horn of Africa, and you still occasionally will see in the news about a ship off of Singapore that's being taken. But there's a lot of continuity in this particular area of interest, and I think the record from 2010 to 2023 kind of plays that out.
Yeah, it's. We probably need to discuss some more current events than just what we've done in the past. But yeah, piracy came and went. I mean, piracy goes on. It's not, you know, it's mostly sea robbery, people boarding ships in the Singapore Strait, stealing small stuff. That's gone on since time immemorial, pretty much. And you know, the Somali pirates, I think they're still running armed teams that come on board ships, sail through that area, get off, and you know, there are arsenal ships out there where they keep their weapons. You know, that pretty much ended that issue. That NATO and the international community still do operate. The Chinese have gotten some great blue water experience by going through doing that exercise for quite a while. But of course, they have a lot to gain by making sure ships don't get taken, since that's one of their important sea lines of communication. If people are looking for variety in shows, if you go back and look, I mean, if you want to hear what military attachés do, we've done that. We could go on and on about the things we've covered. We know in the future we're going to have some of our guests come back again. I think Tashi wants to come on and he's got a new book out and a couple of articles that are important about China. And it's from a historical perspective, what China's learned from their own history and from the history of World War II island campaigns. So I think those will be a good topic. I'm not sure. We're going to talk to a bunch of other folks that we've already got kind of lined up, but now's the time when we start making our plans. So if anybody wants to suggest some people we need to get on here and talk to, that now's the time to let us know.
Yeah, at the end of the month, we're going to have Brian McGrath on to talk about what we mentioned earlier, that the implications of the change of Title 10 and a few of things. Brian's always got a few irons in the fire. And then Toshi is joining us for the last Sunday of the month to discuss his new book. They're both great guests. And yeah. As we're looking to 2023, you know, you mentioned, you know, what's going forward. Obviously, and you go back to January and early February of last year, we briefly mentioned Russia's extended exercise games. And I think our take was that if their Far Eastern forces didn't leave after the exercise was supposed to be done in Belarus, then Belarusia, or whatever they call it nowadays, White Russia will upset everybody, then things might get interesting. And they did get interesting. So that was Russia's play in 2022. So looking to 2023, one of the things I'm thinking about is the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. One thing about the BRICS, besides the fact that it's like back when we were in our prime, the non-aligned movement, it's the modern iteration of that, the nations that really don't want to be pro-U.S., so to speak, though India has kind of changed. But Brazil, if those are the nations to look at, because they all share a fair bit of instability and friction besides what they're trying to do economically, contra the U.S. and Western Europe standing athwart most of the world's international order. Brazil, for those that have been watching it today, they're having stuff in their capital, which unrelated, but God, that's horrible. postmodern architecture in Brasilia. They are having a outbreak of political action in Brasilia today that makes what happened on January 6, 2021 in D.C. look like a garden party. Watched a little bit of video of that this morning. Russia, she's occupied with what she's been doing for the last 11 months. India, interesting, that whole border area between India and China flared up again. I guess it's becoming an annual rhythm. But the thing that's really interesting isn't the little tactical stuff with India that I'll be looking at in 2023, is this year or next, the demographers will tell us, India is going to be the nation with the world's largest population. It will surpass China, whose population will be going through its second or third, depending upon which demographer you look at, population decline, and that's going to accelerate. So they think that sometime towards the late 20s that India's population will peak and also start a similar decline. But that's an interesting dynamic, that the world's largest democracy will also be the world's largest nation once they pass China officially. And the final demographer will give them that heads up probably in a year or two anyway. So it'll become kind of a normal thing. How they continue to get closer to us, that's another thing I'm watching, because they historically have been very close to Russia economically and military source. But that's got to change, especially when they look at how China and Russia are coming close together, and how the U.S. and Australia, Vietnam and Japan all want to work closer with India. So that's, I'm gonna keep it, that's one of the things in 2023 I'm going to look at for India. China speaks for itself. I think the big story, at least for the next few months, to see whether it plays out, is President Xi has decided that the COVID zero policy isn't going to happen. So they are stopping all of their quarantine and lockdown. And a couple of interesting people I've listened to have stated that they are going to have a big catch up in infections, because the rest of the world, you know, at least in Florida, we got back to normal the summer of 2020. So our population has had this virus going back and forth on a regular basis. China hasn't had that, so all of a sudden it's all going to hit them like a wave. It'll be interesting to see whether that plays out culturally more than anything else. But that'll also bring their economy back, because they won't be closing their factories as much. So that's that economic and cultural turmoil in China that nobody from our seats really understands real well. But looking at it from the outside, there are a couple things worth looking at. And what I find the least interesting, which means it's probably the place that will have the problem in the BRICS, is South Africa. We could do probably 10 shows on South Africa if we wanted to. We talked a little bit about it when we had Jack McCain on with his book about the brush war. But great resources, great potential. But I think some of the more interesting things that I've read about things to watch in South Africa is the African National Congress continues to splinter, get weak, and get corrupt. So when that power dynamic changes, it'll be interesting to see how that nation gets its footing. But that's on 2023. What I'm going to do, for the lack of anything else that's tapping me on the shoulder, I'm going to look at the non-Russia BRICS to see what might bring us interesting things on the international stage.
Yeah, those are good thoughts. I'm still focusing on, to a certain extent, on the U.S.-Australia relationship. I know that suddenly that AUKUS is controversial, and I'm not quite sure why that is not being pushed as hard as it should be, in my view. We've got, I'm concerned a lot about the info. I'm beginning to see a diminishing of the power of the green movement. People are not, they don't want to freeze in the dark because somebody has a brilliant idea that sunshine and wind will provide all our power. So, you know, these as nuclear power plants begin to gear up again to keep people alive, and we're beginning to see hopefully this fusion reactor thing that somebody has played with will come to be a commercially viable option down the road somewhere. But in the meantime, there are a lot of small reactors that are available that have already been kind of commercially, have been approved. They just need to be put in place. And in places like New England, where their natural gas supply has been cut off by New York State, and so now they're having to import LNG from Europe, which makes little or no sense to me, but it's the way it works. So, I see those plants being that issue coming back to the fore, and it's important for national security because, once again, energy independence is really important to us, and to the extent that we have it, it's helped stay out of Southwest Asia right now. We can still we don't have to be there. we need to cut CENTCOM back a little bit if we're going to. We need a presence, but we don't need to have a. We need to keep a bunch of high-powered presence there.
Yeah, and I think the American people have had enough of really since 1980 being so deeply involved in that area. You know, after over four decades, it's our economies aren't that reliant on it. And I liked your comment about. The day of reckoning for the green movement, it was going to happen eventually. It's just like, what is the catalyst that's going to take to break the fever, and what will be the sunk cost on pursuing this? It's almost a religion with some people. So if I'm upsetting anybody, that's on you. It's not on me. This is just how you generate megawatts. And you're right that the German people have got to hold their government accountable, because first they put their neck in the hands of the Russians, and they're paying for it now. They're burning dirty coal just to keep their lights on, and for some reason, very capable nuclear reactors, they're getting rid of them while the French are building more. And the French have a very green economy because they know that's the best way to generate megawatts. If not, you're going to be burning natural gas. There was a really interesting couple of things on this topic about Germany. And Peter Zane mentioned something about this a while ago as well, that California and Germany have very similar green incentives, and the Germans get all upset that they don't have the same results that California has been able to get as a percentage of their electrical generating from, quote, renewables, unquote. And I remember this from when I lived there before a couple of years before I started Midrash, is Germany's not California. They don't have deserts in Germany. They're not, at 30 to 35 north latitude. Germany's 45, 50 latitude north, and it's cloudy all the time and it's dreary. You're not going to be able to generate solar there like you can in other places. They don't have wind like we do. And there's plenty of controversy about, wind power, how that works. But if you want to be green, you got to have access to wind. You got to have access to solar. Germany was never going to do that because that's not where she is on the planet. Unless she moves to Mali, they're not going to have the ability to do that. So Germany is going to have a huge reckoning, and I still don't think politically that has played out. They're going to have to generate megawatts. And if they were serious about, quote, green, unquote, they can't burn lignite coal for the next 15, 20 years. They got to find another way to generate megawatts. They're not going to get it by solar. They're not going to get it by wind. They can get it from natural gas from the Middle East and North America and a little bit out of the North Sea, perhaps, from their neighbors, but they're going to have to go nuclear. And if you look at it from an objective point of view, if there is a nation that would do a good job with nuclear power, it would be the nation that has some of the best engineers and technologists in the world, and that's Germany. If they went nuclear, they would do it as well, if not better, than the French, who also have done very good stuff with modern technology, modern nuclear reactors. It's not Three Mile Island. It's not Chernobyl. It's like the difference between a Model T and your brand new Tesla. Technology is very different, much safe. And so that, I think,
choosing electric car as an example is probably not.
I'm waiting. You run over people.
Yeah, I'm waiting for the shoe to drop when people who bought these electric cars, which were subsidized, heavily subsidized by the federal government, in a lot of ways, have to face the possibility of new batteries or whatever is going to happen, because these things are not just like the wind towers and the solar panels. These things are not environmentally friendly. And I mean, I think we had somebody on the show talking about this. It's down the road, there's going to be a big bill to pay for what happens when you try and recycle things that can't be recycled. California's, as I understand, has gotten away with it by reclassifying what every other state has called hazardous waste as not being hazardous because it related to solar power. You know, that,
yeah.
I don't think it's going to float for very long. This is going to happen. People who are, and you can see even in Texas where they've tried to convert to wind, and they certainly have wind and all that. But when the conditions are wrong, when you're driving your electric vehicle and it's 20 degrees below zero, you're not going to go very far. And it's, people have to take a hard look at the choices they're making and whether the environmental goodness they think they're pursuing is actually being met at all by what they're doing.
And I've been a radical environmentalist by my definition since I was a little kid. But instead of these little neo-pagan ideas spouted by Swedish teenagers, my thing has always been pollution. Clean water, clean air, efficient landfills were required, recycling, all that stuff. That's always been my bag because that's actionable. You can measure that. There are metrics involved in there. It's a fact-based evolution that you can see real things in. And one thing I like to point at people about wind power, there's no way to recycle those blades. Those huge windmill blades, they have a limited life, and they bury them in landfills. So be careful how many windmills you want to put up in addition to killing all the raptors we saved from getting rid of DDT. When it's time to replace those blades, they're just being put in the ground. They don't biodegrade. That's a huge part of the windmill industry that's not discussed very well. Is I guess somebody's come up with an idea, maybe you could chip it and melt it, but then that creates toxic stuff. It's a big, big mess. I wanted to go back to something else that you mentioned that also is a 2023 item. You mentioned, at the tail end of the Trump administration, the UK-US-Australia pact for the nuclear submarines. And in separate correspondence, I know you and I bounced this topic back and forth, and since we've done that, I've been thinking about it a little bit more, that it's really infuriating for those that have been tracking it, that on the U.S. side of the house, because of our exquisitely designed submarine infrastructure here, that we can't just flip a switch and build more submarines. And I think a mistake's being made where we rightfully say that we need more nuclear submarines and we can only build them so fast and we can't maintain the ones we have because of decisions that were made years ago, which is, a topic for a show or two in and to itself. But my mind is that we have engineers and we have program managers that need to be told to sit down and be quiet. There's a larger strategic issue at hand here. I think there is a net strategic gain to the United States by if the right answer, because I believe the UK construction isn't an option because their infrastructure to build nuclear submarines is even tighter than ours. So if the answer is getting a Virginia-class submarine, every other one, to the Australians, which we could also start bringing them on and, you know, having them cross-deck with us to train them, as opposed to coming into the U.S. fleet, they go into the Australian fleet. I think that act would have huge positive strategic assets, not only to our relationship, but our relationship with friends in the far Pacific and the Australians, than it would if we just had one more, two more, or three more LA-class submarines in the U.S. fleet. And if things do go to crap in the Western Pacific, and people say, well, we need those submarines for a contingency in the Western Pacific, history and logic shows that if we wind up at war in the Western Pacific, those Australian submarines will be fighting right next to us, as if they were wearing an American flag. Whereas if we let the Australia-UK-US agreement flounder or get pushed to the, quote, out years, unquote, simply because we want those submarines flying an American flag vice an Australian flag, I think that's a huge act of strategic malpractice, and somebody needs to step in and get this conversation moving in the right direction, because if Australia once again looks at the U.S. as a questionable ally and the Brits are embarrassed on top of it, and at the end of the day we just have those extra submarines with American vice Australian flags, I don't think we're playing a smart game if we do that.
I agree 100%. And Paul has asked, excuse me, in the chat room, you know, what are your goals to influence leaders of the U.S. Navy? Well, not just the leaders of the U.S. Navy. We need everybody to write their congressman. Say, look, this Australia, Brit, U.K. thing is important to us. It's important to the world. You know, don't think that by hoarding our assets, we're going to somehow benefit from this. No, we need to show the Aussies and the Brits that we trust them, and that we can that we're all part of one team. And that's just, you know, that is the whole, remember the old thousand ship Navy thing? That is, there's no better way to build that kind of thousand ship Navy than by helping your strongest allies with something that they really need to have to live in the area where they live. And I think that If the message is anything to our Congress people is, you know, let's put enough money into the system where we can build another and train people to build another line or two for construction of these submarines. It can't be that we're being stymied by how badly we've mistreated our contractors on these projects, and it's not really their fault. I think that, as you mentioned several times over the course of the years, that meeting where Secretary of Defense Perry told all the defense contractors that they needed to join each other or die, I thought that, you know, that was particularly inept management of national assets.
Yeah, it was. You know, you were talking about friendship with the Brits and the Australians. What I think was Val Kilner's greatest role in Tombstone, when he played Doc Holliday, towards the end, you know, his character Doc Holliday is asked, you know, why are you doing this? And he was like, you know, the lead character whose name slips my mind, he said, he's my friend. And the other guy said, well, hell, I got lots of friends. Doc Holliday's character says, well, I don't. We don't have very many friends out there we can really count on. The Brits and the Australians, plus or minus a couple of optional wars in the last century, and us showing up late to the party a few times, we've always fought hand in glove with each other. There's a lot of trust in there. And we should make the extra effort to underline that relationship. We're a nation of over 330 million. We're the big kid here. The Brits have a population, I think it's 63 or 65 million. The Aussies have a population that's just a little bit more than the state of Florida, over 20 million. I think 20, 24 million, something like that. What's a few million souls between friends. But rightfully so, we should be able to give them the opportunity to punch above their weight and to solidify that relationship, because we don't have that many friends that have been that reliable for that long. And plus, we don't want to give the French a reason to tell the Australians you picked the wrong friend. We can be an iffy friend now and then. I would hate for us to have another show like that, especially as the events in the Western Pacific demand people to have more confidence in us. Japan, Vietnam, the Philippines. There's even been some nice comments recently from Indonesia. Malaysia historically has a close relationship with Britain and Australia. Singapore is always a nice key. They're all looking at everything that we do, as are the Indians, but I'm just thinking Western Pac right now. And if we flub this up simply because the submarine community can't see outside of their, and I use the word intentionally, bubble, then anyway, I really have trouble believing that we would be so strategically short-sighted as to do that. But that's what I get for being an optimist.
Yeah, well, it is one of those great issues of how we run our foreign policy. You know, speaking of the Australians, just if anybody in the room has a chance, there's a really good book about the Australian Navy in the Mediterranean during World War II. It's called The Scrap Iron Flotilla by a guy named Mike Carlton. I'm listening to the audiobook. He's the narrator of his own book, but he does a great job, and I highly recommend it. One of those, you know, I wasn't aware that almost from the beginning, when the British got involved in 1939, that almost immediately thereafter the Australians dispatched a bunch of older scrap iron, as they call them, destroyers, to help them out, and they spent a lot of time doing some serious work in the Mediterranean before they had to come home and fight the Japanese. So good book. And it does remind me that, you know, that the Australians are have a great naval history, and they are, we should be supporting. As and you know, and we're also talking, you know, you just mentioned Japan. Another thing I'm looking at is, I love how everybody keeps telling us, Japan has given up its pacifist thing. They've never been pacifists. They have a defensive system, you know, and now they're getting into a situation where that defense includes a little more proactive defense, shall we say, that will allow them to engage in. They don't want to fight on their turf anymore than we want to fight on our turf. So it's really important to see how Japan is doing, and it would be really nice if we would return the favor to them by buying some of those wonderful flying boats they have, which I can see being really useful out in the Western Pacific.
Oh yeah, don't get me started on those float planes. And the amazing thing is the TAC Air Mafia, who is always scared that somebody might get a little slice of their pie. I have always been a little distressed that they haven't been the strongest advocates of it, because should we find ourselves in a spot of bother in the Western Pacific, our aircraft will be coming in predominantly from the sea, because very few of those air bases are going to be in any good shape after a few days. They're going to run out of gas. They're going to have mechanical difficulties. They're going to have damage, and they're going in the drink. The Pacific is really, really big, and you're not always going to be in range of a helicopter who might be assigned to do something else. This isn't World War II, where we're going to have the fleet submarines spending all their time on the surface picking up aviators. It's going to be what did a lot of this during World War II. The what was the name of the book? It was about cruisers in the Pacific in World War II, but a regular occurrence in the book was, and it was real, it wasn't fiction, the amount of time that their float planes spent picking up aviators out of the drink because nobody else could do it. They actually, quite a few of them lost their lives because they could never find their way back home to the ship or they crashed when landing. Nothing's better than the seaplane. And the Japanese seaplane, the Chinese are building one too that's comparable. It's a turnkey operation. It actually uses the same engine as the C-130J. So there's a lot of commonality. When you look at all the military kit that Japan buys from the U.S., I think it also would do some good PR work if we bought some of those from the Japanese. We sure could use them on the East Coast and the West Coast here. I think I've mentioned before that it would be, you know, have a split reserves and also USN squadrons if need be, you know, whatever takes, you know, heck, give it to the Coast Guard if you want to. We can use those in wartime. I don't know. But when you look at special ops, when you look at search and rescue, and when you also look at just being able to resupply, the Marine Corps is talking about wanting to, you know, to fortify every island out there. A lot of these don't have airfields. they don't have airfields that are useful for anything but a C-130. And some of these, the only way you can get in and out is by a boat. That can take too long, especially if you have to resupply. You can do that with a seaplane. It was done all the time in World War II. There are a couple of rather obscure books that cover that topic. But as Japan is doing what many of us have wanted to for a long time, they've announced they're going to be doubling their defense budget. And even to a greater extent than we are, they are a maritime and aerospace power. So as they double their defense spending, which with their GDP is going to be significant, most of that is going to go in the maritime and aerospace arena, which is exactly what we have a shortfall of in the Pacific. And if things ever get really bad in the Pacific, Japan's going to be with us. You're right. They're not a pacifist nation. They just, they were shamed by World War II. And they got nuked a couple of times. And we also wrote their constitution for them. But they're coming around to a 21st century realization. And they're a great partnership. And a couple of authors have written that the war in the Pacific was a mistake. There was no reason why Japan should have ever gone to war with us and the other way around. There's really no reason, especially with a now democratic constitutional monarchy that they have now. There's no political movement. There's no resource starvation that we're going to get in the way with Japan. They are as natural an ally of ours as the Australians are. They're just not an Anglospheric nation. They have their own very unique and highly functional culture. But you talk about friends, they're a great friend to have. And I think doubling their defense budget is going to have a great impact for the rest of this decade as that comes online. And a lot of that is going to be spent either directly or indirectly into the U.S. defense industry. So coming back to my, you know, if you want a friend, be a friend. I can see the requirement. A lot of people see the requirement. Again, we're going to mention him again. You know, Jack McCain on Twitter is always jumping in on this, as is Blake Hertzinger. There's like this whole, I know you're there as well, there's this whole seaplane caucus over on Twitter that always beats that drum. But that would be something that we could do as a nod to the Japanese, going that, you know, we're all going to support each other's industry as the West and I consider Japan part of the West, as well stand together to hopefully create a system of deterrence that we don't actually have to go to war west of Wake over the course of the next few decades. So that would be a nice thing to do, to recognize what was going to be coming out of Japan. That's a huge amount of money to go from 1% to 2% of GDP in the area of the world that we need that more than any other. And they're not Japan, and they're never going to be an ally of ours, but they are very friendly to us. And they would, if need be, they would at least be an aggressive neutral. Vietnam's economy and Vietnam's GDP is also rising. And their relationship with the Japanese and with America every year gets better and better and better. Maybe that's a 2030 conversation. But there's reason, if for not optimism, at least a few areas on the board in the Western Pacific that are trending green in our direction, as long as we don't screw it up like we were talking about with the Australians.
Yeah, I'm laughing in the background because the when I was talking about the Japanese and their aggressive defense, it reminds me that Mao called it active defense, which by which he meant the offensive. So it's, you can call it whatever you want. You've got to have the ability to project power, and the Japanese are looking for that and toward that. And there's no reason we can't. I should apologize to people in the chat room. I can't answer anything because for some reason I can't type anything in the chat room anymore. So at least for this show. But yeah, we need to get everybody out there on board with the idea that we don't have to fight the Chinese. And I know a lot of countries out there are kind of, well, we don't really want to make them mad, kind of thing. I think Blake Herzinger just had a piece on that. Yeah, that's right. We don't want to fight them either. But we also don't want them to by default change the way the rules of the world work that have worked successfully and on their behalf, as a matter of fact, to become a thriving nation instead of the backwater third world country they were for so long.
Hey, thanks for reminding me that you're having trouble with the chat room. So while you were talking, I dove into it. And old Southern Nap has a seaplane book, another book recommendation. Let's see, where did I put that? Here it is. It's called, he said, if you want to know how the VP community screwed up seaplanes, he recommended a book by William F. Trimble called Attack from the Sea, The History of the U.S. Navy Seaplane Strike Force. And he has a link in the chat room for those that aren't there. And I'll try to put this up on Twitter if anybody's interested in that. So that is a book I have not read. Of course, it has Will Dalsall, who's also been a guest on Midrats a couple of times. Some of y'all know him as Steeljaw Scribe. He and I had some fun exchange about the Seamaster, the jet seaplane that was supposed to be a strategic bomber. That was a hell of a plane when you look at the stats. But that will be that's interesting to see how I've had some people tell me about the politics, and a lot of it was politics and money. It wasn't a requirement issue that we got rid of the seaplane. It was, it is what it is.
Well, I'm anxious to buy that book because it would be interesting. Man, it don't come cheap though. It's not a free book, so. And there's no Kindle edition that I can detect. But you can get it used for $18.98. There you go. But the used hardcover is cheaper than the paperback. Just saying.
Always a plus. But besides that, let's see. We haven't really, surprisingly, talked about Ukraine all that much as we're coming up on the 1 year. It almost seems it's got to be a calm before the storm. At the end of the year, there's a bunch of people talking about negotiation and what are people going to negotiate. I see no indication that Ukraine has either the will or the desire to negotiate. And I think people need to look at this. It's not a civil war per se, but during the Franco-Prussian War, I think I've mentioned this on Midrash before, General Sheridan was an observer with the Prussians. And when he was talking with the Prussian general staff, they were, you know, ask him, why did your war go for so long? The North had all the industry, greater population, greater trade, and but y'all lost so many people. The war went on for so long. You know, what was wrong? And he said, we were fighting Americans. And there's something about a civil war. And the Russians and the Ukrainians have a long history. If you look at after the Bolshevik Revolution, when Ukraine almost became free, how blood-soaked that conflict was, that didn't even get done until the end of the Polish-Russian War in 21-22, I think it was. They don't really like each other all that much. They never have. That war isn't going anywhere, and 2023 is going to be the year that probably the best thing that could happen to everybody is Putin's illness gets worse, because he's not leaving that job but feet first. And I don't think the Russian government has a very clean and clear political path to get a replacement leader. Probably the only way you would have a quick end of that war would be if somehow Russian internal conflict was such they pulled all their forces home. But it's going to get ugly and uglier.
Well, I saw that at least the president of Ukraine seemed to think that the Russians are mobilizing another 500,000 draftees to join in the fun. And, you know, that part of that is, his call for more modern weapon systems from the West. But, you know, Russia is not, as you know, we already talked about the demographics. Russia doesn't have a growing population. I don't know how long they can bleed themselves the way that looks like they're bleeding themselves.
Yeah, Ukraine has societal collapse demographics as well. It's two old, aging, sick nations clawing each other's eyes out. But the Ukrainians have an existential fight on their hands. They're going to have different morale, but the Russians have size, and they have a little better control over what little industry they have, while Ukraine is becoming more and more dependent on its Western suppliers, though I don't see that changing anytime soon, especially if the rest of Europe joins with Finland and Germany will allow them to send in Leopard tanks. That would be, to use an overused phrase, a game changer. There's been some nice commentary, which is understandable for those that have had to train foreign military personnel on U.S. equipment, that just because you can drive a T-72 doesn't mean you can drive a Leopard 2. And there's a training curve, there's a supply curve, there's a maintenance curve. However, this is a nation at war, and you can take shortcuts, and a crew that can operate at 70% at the front lines is better than a crew operating 0% in the back. So it might move a little faster than people think. And the aviators, a couple people are wondering what aircraft may come from the West to Ukraine. That also, I think, if this war is still going on by June, you're going to have to see that, because they just don't have much left. And I think if they break the seal on sending Western tanks, now that we've run out of T-72s and M-55s to send their way, that once you break the seal on the tanks, then the aircraft will probably follow, because it's really a political decision more than anything else. The Ukrainians will take them and they'll figure it out.
Yeah, I'm also kind of looking at Putin's efforts to pretend that his allies, such as they are poised to come thundering in from a variety of different directions to help the Russians out. I just don't see that happening, because I don't think his allies are really all that gung-ho about joining in the fight, because I would think, among other things, they know they're next.
Yeah. Belarusia, they had that almost revolution a while back. I think if the Ukrainians can kick the Russians out of Ukraine, that's going to destabilize Russia. And if you think the Russians have a bad continuity of government plan, if Putin goes sideways, how do you pronounce his name, Lukashenko up in Belarus? He's been there since the Soviet Union fell. Besides when that uprising took place back in 2020, his son was seen walking around. But I get vibes of Nikolai Ceausescu with Lukashenko and his family as well, that it's kind of run as a family operation. And when it ends, it's going to end really fast and really ugly. I know you and I remember very well the fall of communist Romania. I think it was less than a week. He and his wife were up against the wall, and they took care of that problem rather efficiently.
It was so sad, so tragic. I think I probably laughed. Anyway, you know, Ceausescu or whatever his name was. I mean, what a creep. And so the world, sometimes the world just, what did they used to say in Texas? Some people just deserve killing. So
some people just need a good killing.
Yeah.
An amazing thing is, and here we are, Romania is in NATO. The Romanians have been trying really hard to advance. They haven't been as successful as the Czechs or the Poles or the Hungarians, but they have lots of institutional issues they're working through. They were very supportive of us, especially in the last decade with overseas and working some other issues in the background. It shows you that things can really change rapidly with nations with relatively minimal bloodshed. And if the bloodshed's limiting to having people like Ceausescu and his family put up against a wall to liberate a nation of millions, that's probably something that history will smile upon, so to speak. But hey, I just looked at the clock. We're over an hour for our 13th anniversary show, and we told everybody next week will be a bye week. And I know tonight people will be watching football, but we have Brian McGrath coming up, and also Toshi Yoshihara coming on for the rest of the month. So they won't just have to listen to you and me solve all the world's problems.
I'm not sure we solve them, but we sure do have fun raising them. So, let's. I look forward to another year, and let's get this show on the road with Brian 2 weeks from now, right?
Yes, sir.
All right,
and
cool.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks, Paul and Southern Nap and the other folks who came into the chat room. We appreciate I know some of you who are listening have been with us for the last 13 years, since January of 2010. And we have some of our prior guests that I know are regular listeners as well. If we forgot to mention your name earlier, you can send me a nasty email, or you can send Mark a nasty email, or whatever works. But we appreciate everybody's support, ideas. And until next time, hope you have a great Navy Day, and here's to the 14th year. Cheers.
Like Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the strand and Piccadilly.